Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. I've recently gone back and listened to some of the first episodes that were produced, and I was reminded just how much valuable, relevant insight they still offer. So I'm excited to start re-releasing one episode each week, now with updated remastered audio for a much better listening experience. So look out every Friday for these remaster episodes. This week, I'm talking to Matt McKay about his book, Lessons from the Afterlife. After Matt's son died, he learned how to communicate with him in the afterlife. In this episode, he shares messages he has channeled from his son, Jordan. Hi, Matt. Thanks for coming back to the podcast.
Glad to be here, Simon.
Now we're going to talk about your book. It's called Seeking Your Loved One on the Other Side, Communications with the Invisible Universe. And this is centered on your communication with your son, Jordan. So before we get into the after-death communication stuff, could you tell us about Jordan and what happened to him?
Yeah, Jordan died at 23. He was a computer animator, really very skilled in his job, loved by everyone who knew him. He's on his way home from work late at night, riding his bike. Some people attacked him, maybe just to get the bike. It was a tremendous fight that ensued. And as he was breaking away from them, he was shot in the back and he died there on the street. And I guess I would say that, you know, I think I have the reaction of anyone who loves someone deeply and loses them. And I wanted to know if he still existed. And I also wanted to know if he was okay wherever he was. So those two burning questions just animated me and set me on a journey to find him. There were, you know, many, many stops along the way of that journey. And it started with, you know, just talking to mediums, the famous Felix Lerma, San Francisco, Austin Wells, and having the experience of hearing them tell me what Jordan was saying or communicating. And there was some measure of reassurance in that, but it was a one-sided conversation. I couldn't have any direct contact with him. It just, you know, it just was not enough. And so I continued the search and eventually found my way to Alan Botkin in Chicago, who's a psychologist who specializes in treating trauma. And he accidentally discovered a variation of something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, that helps people in trauma, have trauma, recover from trauma. And his variation on that is called induced after-death communication. He's discovered that using EMDR with people who have lost profoundly, have a profound loss, he could help them actually have direct contact with the loved one on the other side. So that was the first big attempt I had to directly talk to Jordan. And I had the experience of hearing him as clearly as you and I are hearing each other now, hearing his voice and hearing him say the things I really needed him to say, which he loved us. He was still with us. He was watching over us. He was at a good place. He was happy. And so for the first time, I heard directly from Jordan. And that was just enormous. I felt some lightening of the pain. And yet I still had this sense of wanting to have a conversation, wanting to have a two-sided experience, wanting to be able to ask questions and hear answers and respond to him. And so I went on to, with my search, eventually working with the late Ralph Metzner, I learned how to channel. And that was the beginning of this book. It was the opportunity to actually have conversations like we used to have around the kitchen table, in which we could each ask questions and give answers. And I had the benefit of his soul wisdom. You know, he's had hundreds of lives he's lived, and he's in the afterworld where he has access to incredible wisdom and knowledge. And so he began to share that with me, and I learned things that, you know, really kind of blew my mind.
Well, if we could go back to the EMDR, how does that work? Because I think I've got an idea of the process, but how does it work for after-death communication?
Yeah. So what Alan Botkin discovered by accident was in typical EMDR, it's bilateral stimulation. It could be moving your eyes back and forth. It could be tapping one knee and then the other. It could be tapping one shoulder and then the other. It could be sound in one ear and then the other. In other words, alternate stimulation creates a condition in which the right side of the brain can actually begin to communicate with the left side across the corpus callosum, and it allows us to actually process trauma. And so he's done this for years at the VA with mostly Vietnam vets. He had a vet who had been heartbroken for years because he had was going to adopt a young Vietnamese girl who was 9 years old. Her name was Lee. And he did the standard EMDR process, but he did a few things at the end that really were not typical. He had the client close his eyes and allow whatever is going to happen to happen. And to think of Lee in a certain way. It's a little different than the usual protocol. And what happened was the man had a full-blown experience of, he could see Lee, he could hear Lee. She told him incredible things about her gratitude and appreciation for the relationship. She was happy, she was okay, and his pain and trauma just disappeared. And then Botkin went on to do this with so many people, and about something like 89% of them had this experience. Either they could see or hear. Some cases they could physically touch the loved one. So it was very powerful. And for me, it was auditory. I could hear Jordan. I was moved, but also, you know, just incredibly relieved to know that he exists and that he's still with us. He's still part of our lives, still watching over us, still loving us. And that was extraordinary.
What was your experience of the EMDR when you did this? Did it feel like hypnosis or something, or a deep meditation? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I do EMDR. I've done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of EMDR sessions because I specialize in treating trauma. And I've witnessed it, and I've seen how it affects people and how the great relief that they have from their trauma. But I've also experienced it personally, and it is like hypnosis. You feel kind of out of it, kind of floaty, and this almost sort of disengaged from a little bit from sometimes from your body, but from your environment. So there's a way that it's an altered state, and they've done brainwave analysis and found that yes, indeed is an altered state similar to hypnosis, not the same, but it's a very powerful technique that has helped millions of people face trauma and overcome both trauma and traumatic loss.
You say in the book that telepathy across the barrier of life and death is possible. So is that how you feel that your channeling works?
You can open the channel to the other side pretty easily. And I've taught hundreds and hundreds of people to do it. And I found it to be relatively easy. And I don't have any gifts of clairaudience, clairvoyance, anything. I'm not a medium in any shape or form. But when Ralph Metzner, in the space of maybe half an hour, taught me how to channel, I went home that night and followed the steps, the directions, and had this extraordinary feeling of opening, of reception. And as I asked questions, in the way I channel, as I write everything down, I write down my questions, I write down whatever I receive in the form of an answer from Jordan, I began to receive information without sort of being prepared for it. I mean, I opened the channel, went through the process, asked a question, and I had this sudden download of knowledge, and it just showed up. I had to find words for it. So Jordan was communicating telepathically. I don't hear him from the outside like I did in induced after-death communication. I don't hear it as an outside voice. But what I experience is that it's his unique voice, his way of communicating, his style, his language, but also that he communicates things that I've never thought of, never heard of, never imagined. So I'm constantly surprised by what he has to say because it's new to me. It's not mine. And so the experience of channeling from the very beginning was this experience of discovery, of an opening. And what Ralph taught me, which has stayed with me all these years, is that all the loved ones on the other side are just a thought away. As soon as we think about them, we actually open the channel. Now, we don't realize that. So we might think with fondness or you know, grief or regret or whatever. We might have an emotional reaction, but we don't actually realize that at the moment that we're thinking of that loved one, the channel is opening. And if we began to communicate and ask questions, we could get answers. We could get responses. So in our grief, frequently, we are actually experiencing an open channel without knowing it. And Ralph taught me how to exploit that. How to turn that into a choice, into something that I could willingly do.
There were two people who had a sense of Jordan's presence just after he died. Was it Mauchi and Eli?
Mauchi was Jordan's friend, but also his employer. Mauchi ran a computer animation company. They did computer animation for big movies and commercials and so forth. And Jordan was one of the people that did the animation for him. At the moment Jordan died, which is a little after 1 o'clock in the early hours of the night or the morning, he awoke from sleep with this sense of a presence in the room. And it was, he could locate where he felt the presence to be. He didn't know what it meant. It really scared him, actually. But Jordan clearly visited him and confirmed later that he had visited Mauchi to reassure him that it would be okay, and that he would be watching over Mauchi, and that was his intention. But in fact, Mauchi's reaction was really to be terrified and to get up and look around the room and try to see what was there. And he was pretty overwhelmed by it. And, you know, he also visited a number of friends that same night or the next day in various ways, some in, you know, in a dream state, but that kind of dreaming that's so intense and vivid that it's a visitation. You can tell the difference between a dream and a visitation because the visitations have this level of vividness and intensity and emotionality that normal dreams don't. And so he showed up in a number of dreams, with very complex and with specific messages for people. He also showed up in visionary form to several people. Actually, they could see him, and he had special messages for them as well. So he was very busy in the maybe the first 24 or 48 hours after he crossed over, connecting to people. And they all sort of carried with them this sense of his presence, that he cared about them, he loved them, they mattered to him, and he wasn't gone in the sense that he was still, his love was still present in their lives.
But did he come to you?
No.
Why wouldn't he come to you?
Not initially. There, sometime later, it may have been several weeks later, I had a vision. I was awake, but my eyes were closed, and I had a vision of his actual death. He showed it to me. And also that I was actually, my soul was there and present at his death. And I could see that clearly as well. So he showed me that I had been present when he crossed over. And of course, I did not have any knowledge of that at the time. In fact, I was oblivious. I had no sense that anything bad had happened. But several weeks later, I had this vision of the actual experience. He was on his knees at a doorway, knocking on the door, and then collapsing. And I had this and my soul was holding him. So yes, I had some sense of him, but it was several weeks later that I got the first real communication in kind of waking form.
And has he talked to you about the moment of death? By that, I mean, like, for all of us, what happens?
He has talked a lot about it and described it. He initially was confused. He didn't know what was going on. I don't think he's even quite aware that he'd been shot. Something had happened. He's aware that something had happened to him. But he was really trying to get help, knocking on this door. And at some point, he began to realize that when he wanted to move his body, he couldn't. When he wanted to lift up or lift his arm or do something, that he no longer had nervous tissue control of his limbs. And then he started to realize that something really serious had happened to him. He was struck by a sense of sort of a despair, like feeling alone. And at that moment, he began to kind of, by just telepathic movement and communication, start visiting people. He visited his girlfriend who was sleeping. He visited Mauchi, and he started visiting people and observing them, and starting to realize that he could move at will. He wasn't contained in his body anymore, and that was both disturbing but interesting to him. Eventually, he started to feel a tug to leave, he noticed there was some light. He thought actually that it was the dawn light, but it was the beginning of the light of the other side that he was starting to notice and see. And then he describes, his initial experience of landing, the landing place where we all usually end up immediately after leaving our bodies. And he described what that place is like and what its function is and what he experienced there.
So is it like it's for giving you a soft landing when you arrive there? There's lots of spirits that care for you?
Yes, it is a soft landing. I mean, because we leave our body and it's, you know, nothing really makes any sense. I mean, we're seeing, instead of seeing straight ahead as we always do, we're seeing in 360 degrees. Instead of communicating with words and language, we're communicating telepathically. But perhaps more problematic is that whatever we think about, we end up visualizing. And for example, the initial experience was this beautiful garden, which a lot of people experience gardens or places that they love on Earth, and the landing place is prepared for them. It's not energy. It's not physical. It's just energy, but they see beauty. And he saw this beautiful garden with this hyper real or intensely colored flowers and plants. And then he just thought of an elephant. And suddenly there was an elephant in the garden. And he started to realize that. And then he thought of some fantastic creature. I forgot what it was. Kind of like a King Kong type creature. And now he's got the elephant and this creature in the garden, and he's seeing them both. And he realizes whatever he thinks, he can create that image. It can literally turn into, via energy, into an image. And the whole garden is just energy and images that were created for him by guides and the people that are preparing for his coming. But he doesn't realize that whatever's in his mind can be projected out into what appears to be a physical element. So that was kind of, it was hard for him. And he had to kind of adjust and focus on what he saw in the garden. Now his guides, a couple of guides start to show up. And then several people from his just past life. Also, people showed up who were not dead, because part of our soul energy stays in the spirit world even when we incarnate. And, you know, part of yours is in the spirit world right now. Part of mine is in the spirit world. And so the act of incarnating doesn't mean we leave the spirit world. Some of our energy remains there. Some of it enters a physical body. So he was able to see some of the people who are still living because their soul energy was able to visit him in that moment in the landing place. So yes, that's a place where we get reassurance. It's a place where we kind of learn to adjust to not having a body, realizing that you don't have to walk. You move by will. You know, if you want to go to a certain location, you just decide to go there and you just move there without effort or energy. So the telepathy, the seeing in 360, images turning into, you know, energy formations in front of you, and movement by intention rather than effort. All of these things we have to get used to, and the landing places where we do that, and where we, you know, also we get clear that we're dead, that we've crossed over. We're in the spirit world. Some souls, it takes quite a while for them to realize they're dead, and they're also caught up in dramas and struggles in their life. Issues and emotions are very intense, and these souls for a while are ghosts. They hang out, dwell in the area where they died, and it may take them for a while to realize that they actually have passed and to feel that tug up to spirit, and for a while they may remain kind of struggling with what's happened to them and with some sort of ongoing drama in their lives. But in the landing place, that is where we come to some clear understanding that we are now in spirit I mean, getting used to it. Now, there are some souls that have been very damaged by their life, and their soul energy has been damaged by a very difficult or traumatic life. And they may need additional attention. I mean, they basically, there are bardos where healing, spirits who have healing powers will support and help to heal the soul energy. They're basically hospitals for souls to recover from a very difficult life. He didn't have to do that, but he did experience this discontinuity between, you know, on Earth when we imagine things, they just stay in our minds, and up there when we imagine things, they can turn into actual images. So that was the big thing he was sort of adjusting to.
So is there a point then that you get to the landing place, you're an individual, you're still Matt, I'm still Simon, but there must come a point when you realize you're part soul energy and that you rejoin with your soul?
You don't rejoin your soul, you rejoin with your soul group, but your soul is, your soul has left your body. You're still, you're a spirit. You are your soul as you enter the landing place. But now you're experiencing things not through the sensorium that we have in our bodies, our eyes and ears and, kinesthetic experiences. We're now experiencing things telepathically and as images, and we no longer feel things like heat. Although we could imagine it, we no longer feel things like heat or touch in quite the same way we do in our body. So there's a lot of getting used to that goes on initially in the spirit world in the landing place. But also what's happening is that it takes a while for us to recover our memory of who we are in spirit. So initially we're just mostly carrying the memories of this particular life just completed. And yet there's so much that we've already experienced as a soul over maybe hundreds of lives and things that we've learned in the spirit world. So there's so much that we've learned, and it takes a while to recover it. And gradually we begin to recover, the sense of, these other lives that I've lived, this some of the wisdom and knowledge that we've gained, in the spirit world begins to come back to us. So we begin to have a sense of a greater self, not just this one life lived, but this greater self that has been learning and living multiple lives over, I won't say years because you don't measure time as years in the spirit world, but for a long time we've been alive, and we will be alive forever. We will be conscious entities forever, and so we begin to digest all of that, and then sometimes these memories come back piecemeal, a little bit at a time. And it takes a while to kind of get that sense of, that's who I am. I'm this person that has had all these incredible lives. And we begin to be aware of some of the people that we love and some of the souls that we love. All that begins to come back to us. By the time we leave the landing place and matriculate into the actual spirit world, because the landing place is adjacent to the spirit world. It's a spiritual place. It's a place of spirits. But it's not the spirit world, because the spirit world doesn't have pain. It doesn't have, intensely hurtful emotions. It doesn't have a lot of distress, left over from a last life. All that has to be processed and quieted in some way and worked through before we move from the landing place or from these healing bardos into the spirit world. Now, in the spirit world, we've really recovered from the past life. We have memories of it, but the pain isn't really no longer with us. With one exception, the first stop in the spirit world is the life review. And that is where we do have to face a lot of what has transpired in the last life.
Hi, this is Simon. Do you have a fascination with reincarnation? And would you like to know about your past lives? I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. If you'd like to find out how a session works for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website. That's at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. And you said earlier that people from past lives came to visit him.
Yeah.
And is there a thing where if he's there now, but he's had other lives, and to those personalities from the other lives who were part of him, part of his soul, can he visit with them?
No. He can remember or visualize them, and he can go into the Akashic record and see those lives like you'd watch a movie. And he can even see what those lives would have been if he made different decisions in those lives, if had made alternate decisions at certain point or junctures in those lives. So he can observe those lives, but he doesn't merge with them. He merges with the identity of I did that, I lived that. It's like, you know, let's say, you know, you've been married a couple of times. Well, you're in your second marriage, you're not living in your first, you're not there, but you can remember what it was like, and it's part of your identity. The there were things that happened and things that transpired, things you felt, things you experienced that were part of that life that you remember. And that's the same thing. The soul can remember those experiences in past lives, but isn't necessarily going to merge with them and become those. It's just, that's me. I did that, as opposed to I'm right now living that.
So if we were to reincarnate, Matt reincarnates, does that mean it's you that's reincarnated, or does Matt and the whole that you are stay in the afterlife and it's something other from your soul that's reincarnated?
Yeah. Well, Jordan is already reincarnated. He's a teenage girl now. And as I said a few minutes ago, part of our soul energy always remains in the spirit world. So when I talk to Jordan, I'm talking to the part of him and his soul energy and all of his memories and all of his past life experiences that he has access to, because that part of him is still in the spirit world. Part of his soul energy now resides in this body. And what happens, as I think we all know, is that when we incarnate, we go through amnesia. We forget all of our past lives. We forget our life and experience in the spirit world. So we forget this greater sense of self. It's all gone. And there's a good reason for that. We wouldn't take this life seriously. And we wouldn't take the choices and the struggles seriously. And we wouldn't learn the things that we need to learn in this life if we didn't forget and enter this life without that knowledge. So the amnesia, the forgetting process is a fundamental part of reincarnating, because it requires us to take this life seriously. For example, supposing you are fully aware of every, you know, many of your past lives, you're fully aware of your life in spirit and what that's like, and a lot of the things that you've learned, wisdom you've acquired over past lives and the life in spirit. And you come here and you're not going to take seriously the stuff that happens. It's like, you know, this is just, if somebody dies, well, that's nothing. I'll see them in the spirit world. There's no sense of loss. Or we face physical challenges. Well, that's no big deal. You know, I mean, this is just a brief moment in time, and I'll be in the spirit world again. And And so we don't take the challenges seriously here. So that's why we forget. That's why we come here with no memory of other lives and a life in spirit.
So is time, I mean, if we're talking about time passing, what is their view of time from over there? Because I hear that there is no time on the other side.
Yes and no. I mean, it's not time like we have here, you know, where we have things that help us measure time, like the sun coming up and setting, or the tides. There are all kinds of kind of natural events, you know, seasons, planting and reaping, and all. There are all these things that create a sense of time, meaning that things are changing. You know, we measure time here by change, even if the change is nothing more than the hands moving on a clock. In the spirit world, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, hours or days, and there's no measurement of time by, you know, seasons or other physical manifestations. But there is a sense of time. There's a sense of before and after. You know, we're, as souls, what we're doing is learning. We're learning all the time. We learn in the spirit world. We learn in each of our incarnations, in each of our lives. That's what we do. Souls are little learning machines. We're out there experiencing and learning. And so time in the spirit world is, there was a time you didn't know something, and there's a time later you did know something. So the acquisition of wisdom and knowledge is how time is measured. You know, I now know something I didn't know before. And there was a time I didn't know it, and now there's a time I do know it. So knowledge as it's gained and acquired is really the measure of time in the spirit world. And that time is really our development as souls, our growth, our change and evolution as souls is how time is seen and understood in the spirit world.
And I think you, in the book, use an analogy about a river. You could be in the river or standing on the riverbank. Is that right?
Yeah,
that's right. So the spirit world, we're standing on the riverbank. We can look at, from that vantage, we can look at the whole river. We can look at the whole history of time, not only the history of one individual life, but the history of the planet, really. We can look at all of history standing on that riverbank, and we can see it. Because we're standing outside of time. Once we step into the river, when we incarnate, we enter time. Time, at least as it's measured here on Earth, and we're locked in time. And we're locked in time with all the other souls who enter the river at approximately the same moment. And very often we enter the river with people from our soul group, you know, which is sort of like our spiritual family in the spirit world. We all belong to a spiritual family of some kind, and the soul group is usually a group of souls, maybe 8 to 20 souls, who tend to incarnate together. And so they all kind of wade into the river, usually at the same moment, and end up in relationships to each other, and go through time and go through a life together in various relationships. You know, so sometimes we enter the river and one of the souls that is in our group, we're, you know, that person is a sibling, and in other times, in another life, that person might be a partner, a lover, a friend, or even an enemy. You know, Jordan and I in past lives have been a number of different things. I mean, he was actually my wife in a past life. When I discovered that was, I had to get my mind around that. My son was my wife, and yet I had a very clear image of that in a past life regression. In another life, we were in a yeshiva in the Middle Ages, and we were both rabbis. He was an old rabbi who mentored me, and I was a young firebrand. And in another life, he was an unrequited love, and so on and so on. what I'm getting at is that, you know, in people in our soul group or in nearby soul groups, we're incarnating with them over and over again. And it's kind of like a little repertory theater company where we keep going. We enter a new play together and we have different relationships in the new play, but it's the same characters, the same people that are entering the play, even though the relationships are different, the era is different, the environment is very different and so forth. But still, all together, people in soul groups tend to incarnate again and again and again together in various relationships as part of their learning.
And I suppose if they can look down on the river from the riverbank, we're just in the river. And as far as we know, the river is all there is.
That's right. As far as we know, the river is all there is. We know by history and books and you know, things we've learned, something about the river, what's happened in the river upstream from us. But we don't know much at all about what happens downstream and what's awaiting us. And that's kind of the nature of being stuck in the river, is we really can't see where it's going. From the bank, we can see everything. We can see the whole history of this planet from the spirit world. We can see the history of the universe. We can see the Big Bang and everything that's transpired in the development of the universe. We can look at that like we were looking at a movie. And so we have access to all of history and also the future, where the Earth is heading. And we can see all of that from the spirit world. Now, it's interesting, though, because we, you know, for example, when we choose a life, we can actually see the likely things that are going to happen in that life. And we choose lives that will give us opportunities to learn and that we can have a lesson plan that's in that life that's appropriate for what we are trying to learn as souls, how we're trying to develop and grow as souls. So we can choose a life because we can see some of what is likely to happen. And how that may help us learn. But it's also true that once you enter a life and we start making choices, we can change those probabilities. And some of the things that seem destined to happen may not happen or may happen differently because of free will and all the choices we make in the course of a life.
So you had past life regression, was it with Ralph Metzner? How was that experience for you?
It was really intense, really profound. The first one we did, I could see I was living in a little seaside town. I think it may have been in England. And I had this sense of you know, the environment and where we were and actually the house we lived in and so forth. And gradually I became aware of more about the environment. And I became aware to my surprise and kind of really overwhelmed that Jordan was my wife in that life. My daughter was also my daughter in that life. My brother in that life was my father in this life. So it was interesting. Again, that's the way getting at it, the soul group and this little repertory theater where we keep going each life we enter, but we also oftentimes enter in these very different relations to each other. But in that life, my wife, Jordan, dies young. And I kind of withdraw from life in some ways. And my daughter finds someone and leaves, and I don't think I see her again. My son goes to sea. I don't see him again. So I end up pretty alone, and also very disconnected from people, very withdrawn in that life. And I can see the very end of that life and what it looked like in the room I actually died in. But I also saw that I reacted to loss in a really dysfunctional way by withdrawing and shutting down whatever way I could love. And so it was a really important lesson to me to see how I handled loss there. And I was told that I was going to keep experiencing losses until I learned how to respond in a way that was more consistent with spirit, with love. So it was interesting. And then he would show me other lives, and I was mostly interested in lives that I'd had with Jordan, just so I could have a sense of kind of where we've come from, in these past lives and the kind of experiences we've had together. In the yeshiva that I described, he was an old rabbi, I was a young one, and after he died, I continued to communicate with him, and he was telling me a lot of things that didn't fit very well with the belief systems of that group of rabbis. And I eventually got in a lot of trouble for all the things that I was learning from him in the afterlife. And they didn't like at all the idea that, you know, I was communicating with this rabbi, this deceased rabbi. So I got in a lot of trouble. But it's interesting because in this life, we decided we're going to do the same thing. He was going to communicate with me, and I was going to bring what he told me into the world to help people. And so we were sort of on the same path that we were in that Middle Ages yeshiva.
So was that why then he left this life early? That was all part of the plan, the purpose.
Yeah, well, he says, and you know, there are lots of reasons that souls have short lives. That's one of the things that people ask me a lot. You know, what's going on? Why do souls have short lives? And sometimes they come here just to learn a very specific lesson, and that was the case. That's one of the reasons he came. There are certain things he wanted to learn about perseverance and commitment and focus that he came to this life to learn. And he also came to heal. I think I mentioned in a past life, he's had a lot of violence, an experience of violence. And he came here to have a life. He was actually kind of uncomfortable with the idea of reincarnation. So he came here to have a relationship full of love with his parents and full of support. So he kind of healed from that past life, and he wasn't so afraid to engage with living and incarnation. So there were several, you know, reasons that he came, but none of them required him to stay long. And in the current life he's in, my understanding is it'll be a long life, and he's engaged in the plan is for him to have some sort of influence, to be an influencer, in his area of the world. And to use his abilities to influence, to make a difference of some kind. I'm not entirely sure exactly what that means or what that looks like, but he was in this short life to prepare for that longer life where he would use some of the skills that he gained here as Jordan.
Do you know who that person is that's the reincarnated Jordan? Or he just gives you little ideas about it?
He'll describe aspects of his life, you know, and I periodically check in what's going on. You know, he's got a single mom who's pretty focused on other things. He's kind of neglected. But he's really interested in school and education, and he's using that to kind of launch himself. He's in the middle of this new existence, and at the same time, he's still Jordan to me and engaged in teaching people the lessons and the wisdom he's gained over many lives. So he's both this young girl heading into that life and his soul energy in the spirit world is still functioning as Jordan with me.
They ever mention lives on other planets?
Yeah. So he says that this is just one of many, 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 many planets that souls incarnate onto. And Earth is sort of notorious as one of the most difficult places for souls to incarnate and to enter the physical bodies we have here. One of the reasons for that is because these physical bodies are very prone to intense emotion and intense impulses, and they're hard to control. And so souls that first come here and incarnate here, they may have been incarnating in other places, but they come here eventually, find it very challenging to manage these bodies, and the bodies often get out of control, and the soul kind of loses control of the body. And so souls that are incarnating here for the first few times often have a lot of problems. And in fact, not just the first few times. I mean, souls often have serious problems. Like Jordan tells me that Trump is an influencer and came here to this family of wealth and power, thinking that he could use that as a platform. But what he didn't realize was that his father was going to, well, he knew his father was going to abuse him, and he knew he was entering a body that had tendencies for sociopathy. But he thought he could control it, and he could use all the power and influence to do things that were good. And he lost control. He's completely lost control. And he says that's an example of what happens. You know, these bodies have a lot of, you know, their hormonal system and the limbic system, all these parts of our body that really have kind of a life of their own can function very independently of whatever the soul wants to do, and sweep us into things and choices and behaviors that the soul doesn't really want to engage in.
I suppose the reincarnation cycle ends sometime. And then after that, what do we do?
Yes, my understanding is that at some point souls stop reincarnating, and they've learned what they need to learn from the multiple lives they've lived. And now they go on to learn in other ways. I mean, the spirit world has all kinds of learning that goes on there. I mean, there are literally classes that exist in the spirit world where souls together are learning from guides and advanced souls who function as teachers. So there's a lot. There's learning goes on there as it does here. But the difference is that here we learn in an environment in which there's pain, and we have the capacity to learn much more and much more quickly in an environment in which there is pain and adversity and struggle than in the spirit world where there is no pain. Here we're learning how to love in the face of pain. That's our main job on this earth, is to learn how to love in the face of pain. Those are things we can't learn in the spirit world because there is no pain. We can't learn how to love in the face of pain because there is none of it. And so this is the physical planets are a vital part of each soul's development. And it's hard for a soul to develop fully without doing some degree of incarnating, of entering bodies and dealing with the kinds of problems that we have here. He's telling me that, you know, we have a sacred mission here. We come here to learn. And the other thing he says, which has been really kind of mind-blowing to me, is that God is not perfect. God is evolving. All is evolving. And, you know, I grew up as a Catholic, and, you know, that idea was that God is perfect, you know, and God, you know, we come here to be judged and evaluated, and as to whether we deserve heaven or whether we can be saved or not. And Jordan says, you know, that none of that is true. God is not perfect. God is evolving, and God creates little bits of consciousness, souls, to go out into the universe and learn in ways that God could not. For example, you know, God could not understand grief. God cannot learn about grief except through us, by experiencing loss. God can't experience loss. So there are all these things that God can't learn except by breaking into small units of consciousness, souls, that go out into the universe and experience those things that God could not possibly experience by them, it, himself, itself, whatever we want to call them. So this is a sacred mission. We come here to learn. And what we learn then gets uploaded and becomes part of the knowledge and wisdom of God. God develops as we develop. We are all part of God. We are God. We are each human is part of God. And so everything we learn in this sacred mission, in this very difficult, challenging, painful place, becomes part of the knowledge of all.
Well, it's been great talking to you again. The book is Seeking Your Loved One on the Other Side, Communications with the Invisible Universe, and people can get that on Amazon. And is it on Kindle, paperback, and audiobook?
It's not audio, but it's an online book as well as a print book.
And do you have any kind of training sessions for people to show them how to channel?
Occasionally I'll do that in a workshop, but there are, you know, I do see people who are dealing with grief, and I teach them how to channel.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Simon. I really appreciated our conversation.
This week, I was talking to Matt McKay about his book, Lessons from the Afterlife. If you want to hear the rest of this amazing interview, you can sign up to Patreon. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And don't forget, my book, Verified Near-Death Experiences, is on Amazon, and you get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.